I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. It's a thank you this hour in conversation with the late novelist Philip Roth. Our afternoon with him in 2006 at his farmhouse in Cornwall Bridge, Connecticut, was a sort of payoff. I had helped him find just the right Boston location for a scene in his last big counterfactual novel, The Plot Against America. My reward was the chance to record what you're about to hear. Meantime, he had written the slim, late novella, Everyman, about an old New Jersey athlete with a failing heart, pondering failed relationships, physical decay, and coming extinction. I asked Philip Roth to begin our exchange with the last words of Everyman. His unnamed protagonist is on an operating table awaiting cardiac surgery, absorbed in the memory of his own boyhood invulnerability.
Nothing could extinguish the vitality of that boy whose slender little torpedo of an unscathed body once rode the big Atlantic waves from 100 yards out in the wild ocean all the way into shore. Oh, the abandon of it, and the smell of the salt water and the scorching sun. Daylight, he thought, penetrating everywhere. Day after summer day of that daylight, blazing off a living sea, an optical treasure so vast and valuable that he could have been peering through the jeweler's loop engraved with his father's initials at the perfect, priceless planet itself. At his home, the billion, the trillion, the quadrillion-carat planet Earth. He went under feeling far from filled, anything but doomed, eager yet again to be fulfilled, but nonetheless, he never woke up. Cardiac arrest. He was no more, freed from being, entering into nowhere without even knowing it, just as he'd feared from the start.
So beautiful. Is it a redemptive ending or not?
I don't know. Redemptive is not a word I use very much other than the grocery store. I don't think in terms of redemption.
You redeem your coupons.
Yeah. I was trying to be accurate in imagining what might have passed through this man's mind, given what his life has been, and that I'll just paraphrase what I read, really, that having visited, as you know, in previous pages, previous days, his parents' grave site, and he'd been buoyed up by the fact that he was at least near their bones. This is a man without religion, utterly secular, with no patience for any talk about the afterlife, and therefore, he knows that death is death is death. Death is the end, and the rest is nothing. At the moment he's being prepared for surgery, he remembers himself as a kid riding the waves. We used to ride them on our bellies, not on surfboards. And he remembers that thing that you remember when you hang around the ocean a lot, which is the light, and daylight penetrating everywhere. And no, I don't mean it to have any significance beyond its immediate reality for such a person. That is, he thinks this life-loving thought. Really, it's the thought of someone who does not want to leave because it's very glorious to be here. He's had his suffering, but what he remembers is the great glow of those days as a kid. Then I bring in his father's jeweler's loop, which he had a great passion for, the things his father used as a jeweler. So there's the remembrance of a loved childhood thing. I would just say that it seemed to me as close as I could get to the experience he would have then.
It's exquisitely beautiful. I would just add, though, that despite his sense that it's the end of everything, the last part is, as you say, daylight penetrating everywhere. It reminds me of the prayer of St. Francis that ends, you know, only in dying that we awake to eternal light.
I want to dash your optimism.
Go for it.
That's not my intention.
Okay.
My intention is quite the opposite, and that is that this is the last thing he remembers and sees, and then it's extinction. I'll reread the sentence in which that occurs.
Sure.
He went under feeling far from felled, anything but doomed, eager yet again to be fulfilled, but nonetheless, he never woke up. Cardiac arrest. He was no more. He was no more. So the light is gone, and you don't take it with you.
Come back to where you are in your work and your sense of yourself in this period in your life. I mean, you've gone, I would say, from being compared to Henry Miller to being compared to Henry James, which may be a step up.
I've always wanted Henry Aaron, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Hammer and Hank, that's what we call Henry James and Aaron, and Kissinger, for that matter. Where do you feel you are in the saga of Philip Roth?
Where am I? Well, writing. And writing and writing and writing. Mm-hmm. There are things I've stopped doing in order to be able to concentrate all my energy and remaining years on writing. Things like teaching, which I did intermittently over a lifetime, which I enjoyed. I stopped doing that back, I think, in 1993. For a while, I was editing a series for Penguin Books called Writers from the Other Europe, and that meant reading books from Eastern Europe in English, in translation. I don't read the languages. Visiting Eastern Europe and meeting people, that too was pretty invigorating, and I learned a lot. I don't do that any longer. My traveling has been much curtailed. So if you stop teaching and you stop editing books and you restrict your traveling to a 150-mile radius, you can work all the time.
What does it mean in daily practice to be paring down your life?
Well, you're suggesting that perhaps some of the richness may disappear, and I think that maybe some of it does disappear. With it, some of the turbulence, some of the excitement, some of the novelty. There's no doubt that there's a sacrifice involved, but you have to consider energy that's available to you and time that's available to you. I don't know how much time is left to me, and none of us do, and you don't, and I don't, but I read the obituaries every day. I'm getting the idea, you know. And I don't know how much energy is left to me. Right now I feel pretty energetic, but you don't know. So therefore, it seems to me I should try to do what I do best as many hours of the day that I possibly can, and to exhaust myself in that way.
Your work is so smooth, so flows so inevitably and so confidently. What's the process that we don't see?
Well, the process you don't see. Well, you don't see any of the process, of course. You begin, as you know, with nothing. Generally, I begin in desperation because nothing breeds desperation. Where you get an idea from, I don't begin to know. But fortunately, some small notion enters your brain. Then I begin to write things down. If I can emerge from my studio with a page, I'm not downhearted. If I emerge with less, I'm pretty frustrated. If I emerge with nothing, then I want to slit my throat. But
don't.
Well, I haven't so far, but I have emerged sometimes with nothing, and then sometimes you just can't go any further. It's not writer's block; that's not the right phrase to describe it. Is that you're not penetrating the material in the way that will release whatever is strongest in you. The great goal is to connect enough sentences together until you get a first draft, until you've completed the story in its crudest form. And however crude it may be, it's enormous relief to have this thing there. Because now you have something that you can read. So to go back a second time, you see what's missing. And in this book, for instance, use Every Man as an Example. You're reading the thing and you say his father's a jeweler, and you keep reading and you say to yourself, are you a writer or what are you? You're talking, you say his father's a jewelry store. What's a jewelry store? Let's think about it. So as a kid, I worked during the holiday season for a big department store, and we all did, in Newark called Bamberger's, and you would be a stock clerk, and you'd work one day in this department, one day in another department, and, you know, you'd carry things back and forth. I was in the jewelry department for a little bit, so I did see a few things, but by no means everything I have there. And then there are lots of jewelry stores if you walk up Broadway in New York City. So you take a walk up, and suddenly you see there are dozens of jewelry stores where you saw nothing before. And you look in the window, and you go inside, and you see if you got somebody who's willing to talk. And eventually, you hear a few things. And you don't need much, you know. Tolstoy is reputed to have said, you could write War and Peace if you've seen a street fight. So you don't need much to go on. And then when I saw the diamonds and the watches, it just clicked that there was a great resonance in my having my hero play with these things. And just try to be as accurate and precise as you can be. And don't worry about the meaning. I'm not interested in the meaning. That's up for others. Just try to make the object live inside the book. You know, Chaplin was great on, had props. He would have one prop in a scene, whether it was a flower or his cane, as we know, or whatever he had, a shoe that he ate. Remember, he ate a shoe. And there, you have props in a book. I think of them that way sometimes, too. I stop and I say, what are the props in this scene? What are the objects floating around this scene that I'm not paying attention to? And that's what happened with the watches and the clocks and the diamonds particularly. And then, of course, I got a big bang for my buck at the end because I could join everything suddenly, which was the riding the waves and the diamonds and the father's jewelry loop. And it was a thrilling for me, really, at the very end to have all this come up in one sentence. I felt very happy that day.
Coming up, the music in Philip Roth's head. Benny Goodman, Fats Waller, and Shostakovich. Who knew that back in Newark, Roth's father had collected life insurance premiums from Sarah Vaughan's mother? This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Springtime, 2006. We are at our ease with Philip Roth, not in Newark, but in the idyllic countryside of Northwest Connecticut, where, standing at his upright desk in the barn, he had just written a short novel anticipating death called Everyman.
There was a sort of Roth doctrine that emerged in an essay years ago, basically that the wonders and the weirdness of American life had sort of way o'erleapt the imagination of any novelist. And they've kept leaping to the point where it seems to me maybe only a novelist can explain that man on whom nothing is lost, where in the world we are now. That's your job, and it's really why we read novelists and come to novelists, for a kind of distillation of all the symptoms in human terms. Where is this country in 2006?
Let's go back to this Roth doctrine. The Roth doctrine, as you call it, appeared in a talk I gave at an Esquire symposium when I was 27 years old.
My word.
And
in the good old days,
it was
sure.
they were the fresh old days. It was my first public appearance as a writer, and I was scrambling to figure out what to say. I was teaching at the University of Iowa, making 2,200 bucks a year, living like a king, you know. And Esquire magazine was then had a great literary moment. They had two wonderful editors in fiction, Russ Hills and Gene Lichtenstein, and they published a lot of us, Updike and Cheever and myself and Jimmy Baldwin and Bill Styron and who was it?
Mailer,
yes, absolutely. And every year they had a symposium, a literary symposium for 3 days, and I was quite flattered to be invited. And the members of the panel were myself, John Cheever, who I thought was a wonderful writer and was my senior by about 25 years, and Jimmy Baldwin, who I admired greatly, and he was about 20 years my senior, and me, and I was all of 26 and a half or something. So I had to give this talk, and I didn't know what the hell to talk about. I was frantic. I was crazed. And finally, a day or two before, I wrote this, The Roth Doctrine. And all I said in that piece is, it's not engraved in stone, you know, was that having read 20 or so books that had been published that year and the year before, I noticed that the books were, none of them were about the big public scene. They were all about private lives. Salinger was at his height then, and so on. And that the great public scene seemed to have been left to lesser writers. There was a man named Alan Drury, if you remember. A competent writer, and he wrote books about Washington, D.C. Herman Wouk was then in full flower. And Leon Uris and people like that, who I didn't think were of the first rank, however competent they may have been. But that the writers I did think were of the first rank weren't tangling with the big scene, and I wondered why. So I tried to answer that question. And I proposed this notion that the big scene was ungraspable for the moment, imaginatively, by the evidence. That is, I deduced this from what I had read. I didn't know it was going to be the Roth Doctrine rolled back communism in Europe, you know. But the people read the essay, and then they could project a lot into it, and they did over the years. So now you want to ask me, where are we in 2006? I write novels, and otherwise I'm just a citizen who votes and reads a newspaper and thinks his thoughts. But your question presupposes that something drastic has happened between X and 2006. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And if you would tell me what that is, then I'll tell you what I think.
Well, we only know the symptoms. There's a kind of, even before 9/11, a kind of infantilism. The grown-ups disappeared. The authorities disappeared. Seriousness disappeared. There's just kind of a fundamental unreality, it seems to me, about so much of the general public discourse in our country in the last, I would say, you know, not much longer than 4, 5, 6 years, but I wonder where it's going.
I don't know, really. It is a terrible moment, I think. Amazingly, I say this line, I used to hear people say it, I'm old enough now. I'm going to say it now. I'm old enough now. To have lived through a lot of terrible moments. It was a terrible moment, December 8th, 1941. I was only 8 years old, but I knew it was a terrible moment. I was an 8-year-old child, is quite alert and awake. And I remember as a child thinking that something that many adults thought, we could lose the war. That was a very drastic thought for a child to have, and for the adults too. I remember my father had older brothers, and so I had older cousins who went into the army, and suddenly we had a big family. So suddenly I had 10 cousins in the infantry, and some of them were in the Normandy invasion. Astonishingly, no one was killed, but that was pretty terrifying, if not for me, for the family. One of my closest friends throughout my life, he's still a friend, lost his brother in 1944 in the war. I was in his house every day. And so then I went to his house, and his parents were devastated. And those were pretty terrible times. So I, as a child, not an adult, I lived through World War II. And then at the heart of my young adulthood, I lived through the 7 or 8 or 9 monstrous years of Vietnam War. That was pretty, as you remember, horrifying. So this is a different situation, but it isn't the first horrifying public moment that I can remember.
How would you describe the dimensions of the terrible moment we're in? I mean, in your own eye, your own language.
Well, I'm as unhappy as anyone about all this. I'm unhappy about two things, many things, but I'll name the two. One is the leadership, which seems to me utterly inept, indecent, and ignorant. The other is the populace. which is appears to be ignorant, inept. And if passivity is indecency, then indecent too. So there is this sense that one shares with many, many people of great powerlessness, not as though one has any power anyway, but you feel leaderless, and as someone who's never pulled a Republican lever in his life, even at the local level, for the first time in my life, I didn't send the Democrats any money either. I feel utterly without the people who should voice your objections, who should voice your policy, who should voice your outrage, who should voice your indignation. They're not there, and I think this increases one's sense of despair and powerlessness, which is everybody a coward? This creates enormous despair, estrangement from your country, which for me is a very strange emotion. I feel deeply, deeply, deeply American, and I think I share this feeling with others of complete powerlessness and being unrepresented. Mm. And you know, all you do is whine with your friends on the phone. You get tired of the sound of your own voice in its indignant mode. You get tired of the imaginary letters to the editor you write or don't write even anymore. So there is a sense of paralysis and hopelessness and powerlessness, which I did not feel during the Vietnam War.
I'd love you to read a passage that struck me in The Dying Animal, which you must have written, you know, 6 or 8, 10 months before 9/11. But it somehow, when I read it the other day, I thought, wow, we were waiting for something.
Well, I you're right about when I wrote it. It was even more than that. It was probably about a year before 9/11. It's about watching the New Year's celebration on December 31st, 1999, to welcome in the new millennium. And he's watching my character named David Kepesh, is watching the television with his ex-girlfriend who's just been diagnosed with breast cancer, young woman. Yeah. And so she's full of fear for her life. And he's trying to comfort her on this night. We watch the new year coming in around the world, the mass hysteria of no significance that was the millennial New Year's Eve celebration. Brilliance flaring across the time zones and none ignited by bin Laden. Light whirling over nighttime London, more spectacular than anything since the splendors of colored smoke billowed up from the Blitz. And the Eiffel Tower shooting fire, a facsimile flame-throwing weapon such as Wernher von Braun might have designed for Hitler's annihilating arsenal. The historical missile of missiles, the rocket of rockets, the bomb of bombs, with ancient Paris, the launching pad, and the whole of humanity, the target. All evening long on networks everywhere, the mockery of the Armageddon that we've been awaiting in our backyard shelters since August 6th, 1945. How could it not happen? Even on that very night, especially on that night, people anticipating the worst as though the evening were one long air raid drill. The wait for the chain of horrendous Hiroshimas to link in synchronized destruction the abiding civilizations of the world. It's now or never, and it never came. Maybe that's what everyone was celebrating, that it hadn't come, never came, that the disaster of the end will now never arrive. All the disorder is controlled disorder, punctuated with intervals to sell automobiles. TV doing what it does best, the triumph of trivialization over tragedy. The triumph of the surface with Barbara Walters. Rather than the destruction of the age-old cities, an international eruption of the superficial instead. A global outbreak of sentimentality such as even Americans hadn't witnessed before. From Sydney to Bethlehem to Times Square, the recirculating of clichés occurs at supersonic speeds. No bombs go off, no blood is shed, The next bang you hear will be the boom of prosperity and the explosion of markets. Watching this hyped-up production of staged pandemonium, I have a sense of the moneyed world eagerly entering the prosperous Dark Ages. A night of human happiness to usher in barbarism.com. To welcome appropriately the shit and the kitsch of the new millennium. A night not to remember, but to forget.
It's all there. Everywhere. The explosion of markets, the prosperous Dark Ages.
Yeah.
The kitschification of just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about kitsch.
It's not, I know the word, of course. It's not a word I use very much. I think we lived with it so long, we don't even have a word for it. It's, you know, soon the word air will go out of existence because we live with it so much. When I was a high school kid, I started high school in 1946. And television began in 1948, really. And popular culture just grew and grew and grew and grew. And by the time I was in college, or in graduate school at the University of Chicago, David Reisman was there, and he was writing The Lonely Crowd, you remember. And I used to go to his classes, order his classes, and they were in mass culture. The assumption, I remember sitting in those classes listening, was that there was this thing, popular culture, which we could look at, and it was out there, and it was like Vesuvius, you know, it went off only once every 6 billion years, that it was contained in some volcano. And we heard its rumblings, we looked inside, you know.
And what was it when you looked? Was it Frank Sinatra or...
Well, it was, no, we wouldn't attach any names to it. It was just that there was great cheapness and great shallowness and stupidity, ignorance, etc. That this popular culture was taking over American entertainment, they thought. They didn't think at that moment that it would take over everything. That when it erupted the lava, we'd run like hell from the lava, you know. And when last seen, we were still running. But what I'm getting at is that back in 1955, say, in that classroom, we all thought the University of Chicago would win. You know, it would be 21 University of Chicago, 7 popular culture. That would be the final score. I think that was the assumption that there would continue to be an audience of discriminating consumers of entertainment, of books, of art, of thought, of thinking. And it would seem quaint now to sit in such a classroom because you would just have to say, it didn't turn out that way. It didn't turn out that way. The other thing has conquered.
That's so interesting as a way to put it. The other thing has conquered, which is fine in a certain way. I'm thinking, as you speak, of cultures, musical cultures of Cuba, say, or Brazil, where the whole country sings the same songs, and they know them, and they're very, very good. It's not one stuffy little elite culture, you know, lording it over, you know, lousy pop. It's a much more integrated culture generationally and in terms of real beauty and lasting significance. And
may I quarrel with your... I know you were just speaking colloquially, but I would quarrel with your stuffy elite. Discriminating audiences aren't neither stuffy nor elite. They're discriminating.
Right.
Last night, I was in New York. I went to see the third in a series of... Shostakovich Quartet recitals that's being given by the Emerson Quartet. And these quartets of Shostakovich are unlike anything else in the 20th century. And a third of the hall was empty. This is Alice Tully Hall in Lincoln Center. Now, that's okay with me, and it's probably okay with the Emerson Quartet, and it's okay with Shostakovich. But the people who were sitting there were not stuffy or elite. They were people who find great pleasure and sustenance in listening to Shostakovich. So I don't think we should yield to the descriptive terms that are used by the enemies of high culture, because high culture is and valuable, and is neither stuffy nor elite.
My question is still sort of what became of the popular culture that you and I loved growing up. In Sabbath Theater, there's an incredible scene in the car with a German girl where Sabbath sort of does the play-by-play of Benny Goodman's concert in 1938. But I'm also thinking of a scene, this wasn't you perhaps, in the movie of The Human Stain, where an absolutely exquisite girl takes her clothes off to the music of Johnny Hodges playing Daydream with Duke Ellington. That was a culture to live with all your life.
We mustn't romanticize or sentimentalize the popular culture with which you grow up, and I, who am somewhat a little older, and I grew up. There was crapola extending to the horizon too, and a lot of it I liked. You know, I was a kid. Kids are entitled to like crap. Adults are entitled to like crap. It's just when the crap explodes like lava and you got to run like hell to escape it that you wonder. But they're still, after all, the Emerson did perform last night at Alice Tully Hall in Lincoln Center.
This is Open Source with Philip Roth in his living room in Connecticut. We'll be back after a short break.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Archive. It's May 2006, and we're in the field with perhaps the most decorated American fictionist of our time, the modernist and sensualist, the epic storyteller and flawless sentence maker, Philip Roth.
Philip Roth, we're privileged to be here, and I have to say, moved by your work, moved by your awards. Among them, I understand there's a Philip Roth Square in Newark, New Jersey, just dedicated.
No, I'm Philip Roth Square. It's Philip Roth Plaza, actually.
Oh.
Yes, Philip Roth Plaza. In October of last year, October of 2005, a street corner in Newark, the street corner close to the house where I was raised as a kid, was renamed Philip Roth Plaza, and there's one of those green signs that, you know, shines in the darkness. It says Philip Roth Plaza, and a plaque on the house, which says Philip Roth's home, I think, and then a text underneath it. And there was a ceremony late October 2005 with the mayor, Sharp James, the outgoing mayor of Newark, quite a man, and a crowd of about 100 people who that day had taken a bus tour of spots that are mentioned in books of mine. And an actor was with them on the bus. And when they got to the spot, they all had to listen to this actor read whatever the sentence or paragraph was about the place. And then they wound up on Summit Avenue, which was the name of the street I grew up on. And there they were when I drove up in the car. There were these 100 people outside my house. I'd never seen 100 people outside my house before, but it was a wonderful day.
So at all costs now, you'll be known for the plaza.
I think so.
I remember Philip Roth.
Forever.
The plaza guy. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Especially with a guy who's been so faithful to Newark. Mm. You are the memory of Newark.
What does it mean? It was a wonderful day, and I had a wonderful time. There was a reception, and I asked that the reception be held at the local branch library where I'd gotten my books as a kid. So we all went down there, and there was food, and there was another little ceremony, and the mayor read aloud from The Counter Life. Great reading. He went to a place called Southside High School, which was mostly black in my era. At that time, that was the only black high school in Newark. That blacks were a very small proportion of the population then. And I went to a high school that was largely Jewish, called Weakwake High School. And before Sharp Jane began his reading, he said, "Now, you Weakwake boys think that Southside boys can't read, don't you?" I said, "I don't know. Let's see what you can do." So he read aloud this passage, wonderfully, by the way, from The Counter Life.
Where is Philip Roth Plaza in relation to Sarah Vaughan Square? A little older than you, but same town.
Yeah, well, she's only about 10 years older than me, I think. My father used to collect insurance money from her mother.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know where. I guess she was in the Central Ward, which is the ward that was hardest hit in the riot and fires of late 60s. It would be, I'd say, about 2.5 miles away. Mm. You can walk there.
I'd love you to read a passage from your wonderful book about your father, Patrimony, in which his immortality, in a certain way, is what he remembers about Newark. Every brick, it seemed. Mm-hmm. You know the passage I mean?
Sure. It's a passage that occurs midway through the book when my father has been diagnosed to have a brain tumor. It was a benign brain tumor, but what killed him was the mass of it, not that it was a malignant tumor. And I was on the phone talking to my good friend Joanna Clark, and I was telling her about him. I'd spent the day with him. I think I'd taken him to the hospital that day, and we'd been driving back and forth across Newark to get to the hospital and then to drive back to where he lived. And we're talking about suicide, what kind of solution that would seem to someone like my father. And I said, and this is the book, I'm reading from the book now, I said, not him. We're speaking on the phone. I said to her, he doesn't even have it as a fantasy solution. I was over there today to get him to the doctor. I had to drive him across poor, poor, poor old Newark. He knows every street corner where buildings are destroyed. He remembers the buildings that were there. You mustn't forget anything. That's the inscription on his coat of arms. To be alive to him is to be made of memory. To him, if a man's not made of memory, he's made of nothing. See those steps? He says to me, 1917, I was sitting on that stoop with Al Borok. You remember Al Borok? He had the furniture store. I was sitting there with Al the day America went into the war. It was springtime, April or May, I forget. That's where your aunt had the candy store. That's where my brother Morris had his first shoe store. Gee, is that still there, he says? On and on. We passed his school, 13th Avenue School, where he was the teacher's favorite. My teacher, she loved me. Herman, she said, on he goes all the way across the city. And Joanna said to me, well, life. She's pretty smart. Well, life, she said. I said, you can say that again. We get to the hospital, and he says, what a blessing for the city of Newark when they built this hospital. That was really my father all over, thinking. The mode of thinking was civic-minded and proud and full of allegiance. Not corny, I think more or less as it should be, you know. He enjoyed his memory, especially as he came from a place that had been destroyed. You have to remember that this city, which when I grew up, I think it was we were always very proud. It was the 16th largest city in America or something like that. And we had a AAA ball club, and it was the Yankees ball club. And so it was a medium-sized American city, less than 500,000 people. And he grew up there. He was born there, and as were his brothers and sisters. And my grandparents came in about 1890. My father was born in 1901. And he lived there the better part of the 20th century. And then in late 1960s, as you know, Newark was, there were riots, and the city was, a good portion of it was burned to the ground. And it never, never, never has recovered. He took it like he'd spent 10 rounds in the ring with Sonny Liston, like terrible blows to the head and the body. And they moved off to Elizabeth, New Jersey, where my mother had been born. But he had a heartache for this place, and his memory of it was informed by his occupation, because he had worked to begin with as an insurance salesman for Metropolitan Life, and in those days, as you know, insurance salesmen went door to door, not only to sell the policies, but to get the premiums. So you went around every week with some people. If people had a burial policy, they paid a quarter a week. And they weren't going to mail it in, and they weren't going to go to the office to pay it. And if you didn't want their insurance lapse, you had to go to the house and get 25 cents or 50 cents. I'm not exaggerating. It was as little as that. Yeah. So he knew every, he did indeed know every house on every street. He knew every basement because people lived in the basements. He knew every stairwell. He knew what dangerous dog lived at the top of the stairwell. He was like a mailman. So he carried a map in his head. It was also an ethnic map. I don't think the word ethnic was used then. There was the Irish neighborhood and the Polish neighborhood and what was then called the Negro neighborhood and the Jewish neighborhood where I lived. And he had this map in his head. So I got that map in my head. The city was engraved in my head, too, by virtue of his memory. And I remember when after my mother died, my father was living alone in the apartment they lived in a rather pleasant building in Elizabeth. And the way he met the woman who was later to become his, I love this word about older people, his girlfriend. the way he met her was he was looking out his back window, which looked down. He was about on the seventh floor, let's say. And there was a parking area for everybody, and everybody usually used the same slot. And he was standing at the window, and he saw someone pulling into Dr. Horowitz's slot. So he raised the window, and a woman got out of her car, and he said, "Hey, you're in Dr. Horowitz's slot." So she looked up and said, "Excuse me?" He said, "That's Dr. Horowitz's spot." And then he looked at her, he said, "You're a good-looking woman. What's your name?" he said to her. She was then about 60. My father was then 80. And she told him her name.
But looked 70.
Yes, he looked 70. Yes, he was very vigorous.
Felt 60.
Yes, he always said, always tell him you're 10 years older than you are. Because if you say you're 90, they say, "You look great." Whereas if you tell him you're 80, you say, "He looks 80. He's 80. He said, "You're a good-looking woman. What's your name?" She told him. He said, "You were married to so-and-so, weren't you? I knew his father ran a stationery store on Central Avenue." She was dumbstruck by it. He said, "Come on up here. I'll give you a cup of coffee." So he picked up his girlfriend that way. And they had a good life, actually, for a while, until he got sick. But he did know not only where everyone lived, but how everyone earned a living. I'm not exaggerating when I say everyone. And he loved, he was a real novelist without a novel. He couldn't write. I mean, he only went to the eighth grade. His writing was very poor. His handwriting was poor. His spelling was poor. He could read the newspaper, but he couldn't read a book, really. He couldn't sustain that concentration and focus. But everything else that you could know, thingism, he had thingism, like I think William Carlos Williams speaks of it. He knew where everything was, the names of all those things, how things were made, who made what, and so on. So those are real novelist gifts, you know.
You've been a stickler over the years. When anybody wanted to classify you as a Jewish American novelist, you've always pushed back hard to say that you are an American novelist, in very much the same voice, I think, that Ralph Ellison insisted he was an American novelist, or Duke Ellington was an American composer, and George Gershwin was an American composer. In this nichified world of many celebrated identities, who's speaking for all of us?
Well, the literature speaks for all of us, taken together. Each writer speaks for his or her own imagination and its strengths, and has no obligation to speak for anything or anyone else, nor do I think anybody worth his or her salt does do that. I don't have much sympathy with reading through the tribal lens, you know. I don't read John Cheever as a Christian American writer. He would be appalled if I said, "John, today, I mean, poor John has died, but you're a great Christian American writer." Or, "John Updike is a great Christian American writer. So why am I a Jewish American writer?" I write out these people I come from, the people I know. You know, Isaac Singer, who was born in Poland in, about 1915, let's say. When he came to America and began to write here, and he was chastised sometimes for his subject because people challenged him and said, "Why do you write about Jewish whores? and Jewish gangsters and Jewish thieves, Jewish pimps. And he said, what should I write about? Portuguese whores? Portuguese thieves? Portuguese pimps? He says, I write about the pimps and the whores I know. So I write about what I've known. I write about what it is to come from that place that I knew. I happen to come from a place that's become a tragic place. And I don't think if Newark had not burned to the ground, I would have written another word about it after Goodbye Columbus, Portnoy's Complaint. But when I came back from living in Europe for a long time and began to look around for what I was going to write next, I realized, as you often realize, it was staring me right in the face. It was right in front of my nose. It was this Atlantis that I'd come from that had been lost. And suddenly Newark was Prague. Newark was the West Bank. It was all these places that I'm interested in there, where people live under pressure. And I realized the place I came from was now a place where people lived under pressure, and that was lost to those who had once lived there. And then the place became interesting to me, not as a background. It's just a background, really, in the early books, but as a place that had a historical fall, a great historical fall, you know, and still fallen.
Philip Roth, I don't want this hour to end. Thank you enormously for the pleasure of this conversation, and thank you, I must say, for a lifetime of spellbinding work.
You're very welcome.
Before leaving Philip Roth's living room, we asked him to read one of our favorite passages from Everyman. Here we find the protagonist on the Jersey Shore remembering the spectacularly simple pleasures of boyhood.
He got out of the car on the ocean road and went up onto the boardwalk and sat on one of the benches that looked out to the beach and the sea, the stupendous sea that had been changing continuously without ever changing since he'd been a bony sea-battling boy. This was the very bench where his parents and grandparents used to sit in the evenings to catch the breeze and enjoy the boardwalk promenade of neighbors and friends. And this was the very beach where his family had picnicked and sunned themselves and where he and Howie and their pals went swimming, though it was now easily twice as wide as it had been then because of a reclamation project recently engineered by the Army. Yet wide as it was still his beach, and at the center of the circles in which his mind revolved when he remembered the best of boyhood. But how much time could a man spend remembering the best of boyhood? What about enjoying the best of old age? Or was the best of old age just that, the longing for the best of boyhood, for the tubular sprout that was then his body and that rode the waves from way out where they began to build, rode them with his arms pointed like an arrowhead and the skinny rest of him following behind like the arrow's shaft, rode them all the way in to where his rib cage scraped against the tiny sharp pebbles and jagged clamshells and pulverized seashells at the edge of the shore. And he hustled to his feet and hurriedly turned and went lurching through the low surf until it was knee-high and deep enough for him to plunge in and begin swimming madly out to the rising breakers, into the advancing green Atlantic, rolling unstoppably toward him like the obstinate fact of the future. And if he was lucky, make it there in time to catch the next big wave, and then the next, and the next, and the next, until from the low slant of inland sunlight glittering across the water, he knew it was time to go. He ran home barefoot and wet and salty, remembering the mightiness of that immense sea boiling in his own two ears and licking his forearm to taste his skin fresh from the ocean and baked by the sun. Along with the ecstasy of a whole day of being battered silly by the sea, the taste and the smell intoxicated him so that he was driven to the brink of biting down with his teeth to tear out a chunk of himself and savor his fleshly existence.
This conversation from the Open Source Archives was produced and recorded by Chelsea Mers and David Miller, with help from George Hicks and Mary McGrath. There's loads more where that came from. John Updike, Saul Bellow, and Norman Mailer in the famous Writer's Vault,
Carrying On Now with Philip Roth at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.